Call the meeting of Education Finance to order, and we don't have a quorum, so we'll pass on that right now on taking the roll. And Representative Howes, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I apologize, I don't remember the file number, but you can't bring it up to talk about it without a quorum, correct?
Correct, yes.
All right, so I will talk about House File.
2838.
All right, 2838. The argument's been for years about the transportation money that the Bemidji School District gets compared to, we always pick on Richfield, no offense to anybody if they live in Richfield right now. And Representative Greiling, I'm sure, has heard this issue many, many times. I've tried to put this down into really simple terms, and I'm using your numbers for transportation that are called the basic numbers. Now, Bemidji gets $31 million in that line. Richfield gets $26 million. Looking pretty good for Bemidji so far. But Bemidji has 958,000 miles. Richfield has 153,000. When you divide those miles into the money, Richfield gets $169 a mile, and Bemidji gets $32 a mile. There's some discrepancy there. Now, I'm not coming in here asking you to change the formula statewide because it's still not going to help. If you give everybody $10 more per pupil, we're still way behind. And then if you add the sparsity for Bemidji, which Richfield doesn't get, it's 0.0004 cents, which is still appreciated per mile. So what I'm saying here, $169 per mile for Richfield, $32 a mile for Bemidji. Obviously, it's not the amount of students, it's the miles that wear out the bus, that costs money to pay the bus driver, the repair and maintenance of the buses. It's not fair. So what I'm asking this committee, I think it's either $230,000 or $250,000 one-time money to help Bemidji with this issue, and hopefully next year when we do the budget, we can address this on a more specific statewide or districts that by some anomaly are getting shortchanged. And I'll stand for any questions. I understand you're just going to lay it over for consideration.
That's correct, Representative Howes. Before we go to questions, do you have any other testifiers on this?
No, the superintendent really wanted to come down, and I told him, with the amount of money you're getting per mile, you simply can't afford it.
Representative Howes, we do have a quorum now, so the chair will move your bill and put it before the committee.
Okay.
Representative Briner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howes, you said it was a one-time appropriation, but the language of the bill says this is an ongoing appropriation. So could you clarify?
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Breinert, evidently I misunderstood. I thought it was a grant, but I would take permanent funding, so I'll pass it.
Oh, noted. And yet, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howes. You're representing your district well, and I'm wondering, people in this committee who are tired of listening to me are familiar with the question I'm going to ask you, but I always like threshold bills rather than bills for specific districts, assuming that others also would qualify if we had everybody in here that would qualify. And you know, every time we try to do one thing, it comes out somewhere else. The small schools revenue doesn't help Bemidji, and you know, you do something for one and not the others, which is why I like comprehensive reform. But if we're going to do something for a specific problem, I at least like it to be a threshold bill. So did you consider that, and what other districts then would qualify that have similar traits to your situation, and how much would that cost?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, I can see by some of the members you have on this committee that it probably would affect them also. It doesn't affect them as much as Bemidji School District, and I'm not sure why. It's just maybe the way they laid out the district. But and I agree with you. We should do things that way. In the bills that I've been carrying, or the one I'm carrying today, every time I try to do something maybe in northeastern Minnesota, I have to take something away from St. Paul, and that doesn't work, and then I try to do it a different way. That doesn't work. But, you know, we've been trying for years to fix the problem with Bemidji. It's been 10 years that I've been working on it. Never seemed to get anywhere. I'm tired of not getting anywhere. It's great to do the whole thing, but we've got to do some balance somewhere, and if we don't take that one small step for man, we won't take that giant step for mankind.
And
just thought of that.
And Representative House, it is worth pointing out, maybe you have already, that, Bemidji is an exceptionally unique district. One of the first things we hear in this committee is we talk about how the fact that there is no such thing as an average district in Minnesota.
No.
And if we were to put money into transportation or even transportation sparsity to try to get to address the Bemidji situation, the unintended side effect of that is that you're going to be basically overfunding transportation in districts like mine. But Representative Gradley, did you have any additional questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask that my question to the fiscal staff.
Mr. Crow or Mr. Trump, do you want to repeat the question to him? Representative Greiling, or did you hear it?
Other districts that would qualify if we tried to put together a similar trait with this problem list.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I think there are a number of things to think about. The Bemidji School District square mile area is quite large relative to most districts in the state. There are obviously some other districts in Representative Anzelk's legislative district, for example, that have even more square mile area for those school districts. But in terms of its defining characteristics, certainly one of the aspects is the number of miles driven in that district. Another feature of that district is the geographic impediments, perhaps, are a way to describe them. Areas where things may not be real far apart, but where there's a lake or a highway or a river in between often mean that a bus route gets quite a bit longer than it would otherwise be because it's got to go around the lake or to the nearest bridge in order to get across to the other side. So those are certainly some of the factors that would make the Bemidji School District more unique than most other similarly situated school districts.
Representative Greiling.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Enzels, have you checked out that your districts probably, if this were a threshold bill, would qualify?
Representative Enzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greiling. Four of my seven school districts would qualify.
Thank you. Well, then that makes my point that, you know, I think it's great to help out some kids, but I think we should help all kids in a similar situation whenever we have bills like this.
And Representative Anzels and Representative Greiling, what threshold are we doing there?
Yeah.
Are we using a sparsity measurement, or what's the, I'm trying to figure out what we're using as a qualifying measure. Are we just saying that they're really large districts that have very few students? You're the one who said that four districts qualify, Representative Anzels. Don't look at her. All right, Representative, any additional comments from members of the
committee? Well, I have a solution to that. We did in rules, you know, with interim per diem. If you live in a district that has a certain amount of square miles, you're eligible for $250 more per month, and that's about 20% more than other districts. So I would be more than satisfied to give Representative Anzelk School District 20% more, my Bemidji 20% more, call it a feel-good bipartisan effort for education, and I'm sure the governor would sign it. And thank you, members and Mr. Chairman. And I apologize for not having the tie. My staff has not given me enough time.
Thank you. With that, the chair renews his motion of House File 20. We have Anzels first, and then Fabian. You're not done yet, Representative. Do you need to get to your committee, Representative House? Or?
No. I have other things to do, but I have a few more minutes yet.
Okay, Representative Anzels.
Really, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The range delegation and others from the northwest area of northern Minnesota discussed this with Representative Hulls, and it looked, just looking at the maps, looking at square miles, getting a snapshot of what bus routes look like, at least half of our districts would qualify in theory under what Representative Hulls is talking about here.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would probably be for Mr. Strom, but at some point it would be nice to maybe get a snapshot on how we do the transportation funding again. I mean, just I realize it's a difficult request and short notice, but to kind of walk us through how we do that, that would be good, including the regular transportation and also transportation sparsity. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Howes, any
questions? Mr. Chairman, well, there would be an option if you were, your committee would want to consider and change it from permanent funding to a grant and send it to Ways and Means, and I believe there's a bill going to Ways and Means next week that it might be attached to.
It might. Any closing Thanks, comments, Mr. Representative Chairman. Howes?
I'm done.
That was it. All right. With that, the chair renews his motion. The chair renews his motion to have House File 2838 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Howes.
Thank you.
Representative Quam. Representative Quam moves that House File 2917 be moved for possible consideration in a later bill. Representative Quam, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a pretty straightforward bill. Basically, there's been a, for about 50 years, an obscure subdivision that set a different ratio for schools that have some part of a city of the first class. Until Rochester became a city of the first class, all the other cities of the first class had their school districts exempted from this imposition. We discovered that this would impact, I believe, three school districts, and it would be less than 5% of the regular normal limit that they have been used to. And so instead of going the route of an additional exemption, my feeling was, if everybody's going to get exempted anyway, why not get rid of our arcane subdivision of law? So that's the intent of this bill. I do have a testifier, but you know, we can use the testifier to respond to questions as opposed to taking up committee time.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Quam. To the testifier, did you have any statements you wanted to make, or do you just want to be available for questions?
Mr. Chair, I can be available for questions if that pleases the committee.
Okay. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this hearing and move to member questions. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this isn't necessarily for Representative Quam, but just for the committee in general. It seems like this is yet another one of these examples where we have one set of statute for cities of the first class or school districts connected, and then another set of statutes for everybody else. And it sounds like you're trying to get rid of one of those things. So I think that's all to the good. But I, you know, unless somebody comes up with objections that I don't know about, I just didn't hear any just now. But I still go back to charging next year's legislature or somebody to want to examine why we seem to want to cling to this different statutes for the different school districts. And we've had one bill this year that ended up starting out to address the issue but still ended up with differences. So I just think it's maybe the people from Minneapolis or St. Paul or Rochester or somebody has a knowledge of why we don't want to do this. But does anybody know why we wouldn't want to do that? Have one set of statutes for everybody?
Oh, Representative Dabney. Representative Growling, I'm going to take a stab at this. And I think when I've looked at the statutes, whether it's well, just looking at Dot 40 and Dot 41, there are certain benefits that Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth get in terms of flexibility of staffing that as cities of the first class that non-schools don't get, but that there are also restrictions that are imposed on that. So while we would probably find some school districts that would like to have some of the flexibility Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth have, there are other provisions in statute, in fact, in the same section, where some districts would not like the newfound restrictions that would be imposed on them. And so if we were to simply take the cities of the first class language and overlay it over the rest of the state, there would be some things people would like and not like. If we did it vice versa, it would be the same way. And I think that's kind of my analysis of it. But Representative Dabney, you're from Minneapolis. You can offer some thoughts on it.
Well, speculation and then a point.
First of all, I think you've got a perfectly valid point, Representative Greiling. My understanding is some of this is historic, that the, and it may be incorrect, and staff can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but that some of those provisions that the chair is referring to existed for the cities of the first class before companion statute existed for the rest of the state, and then for whatever reason, slightly different statute was drafted for the rest of the state. But I would point out that this isn't a historical artifact we're talking about. Representative Kelly wants to treat the cities of the first class differently. Representative Woodard wants to treat the cities of the first class differently. Chair Garofalo wants to treat the cities of the first class differently. Representative Qualm arranged that we define cities of the first class differently in last year's bill, because Rochester is a city of the first class, except when he doesn't want it to be a city of the first class. So it's not just a historical dusty artifact of statute. It's political fun for people.
Before we, Representative Greiling, if we could just have Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow just speak about Subdivision 5 and just give us a little bit of a history on this specific item.
Mr. Chair, members, the provision in Representative Qualm's bill deals with a separate subdivision in Chapter 475 in Section 475-53, Subdivision 5. And as was suggested by the chair and others earlier, this is indeed an artifact of older language regarding the city of the first class's relationship to its school when the two were much more tightly entangled. The rationale for the separate debt limit is not entirely clear to me. As one tracks that back over the last 60 years, you can see places where that debt limit was further and closer to the debt amount for the other school districts in the state. But essentially what Subdivision 5 does is have this relatively low debt limit apply to those that are partly or wholly within a city of the first class. And, Mr. Chair, in the bill summary, the seven school districts that are partly or wholly within a city of the first class are listed. As committee members know, Rochester's status as a city of the first class just came about as a result of the 2010 census. So the situation is new to those districts in that area, to the Rochester, Stuartville, and Byron school districts. A fair amount of the language that goes back into the 40s and before on the provision related to the separate net debt limit also involves the charter status of the committee and some other thing of the city of the first class and some other issues that are as I said, entirely less relevant now. For example, it wasn't until about 20 years ago that the provision that required first-class city school districts to have their bonds approved by the governing body of the city before anything else happened, in addition to the debt limit, was removed. So I think the interwoven nature of that is more a historical artifact with this provision than anything else. It would be interesting if there are others that have any view of whether there was rationale for why that separate debt limit was set at the level it was. I have not been able to find out the rationale why there. When one tracks the changes in that debt limit since in the last 40 years, those are mainly done as proportionate changes given other changes to the definition of the tax base. For example, for a number of years prior to 1989, we were on a system of mills and assessed value. When that language was changed to net tax capacity and gross tax capacity, the rate was changed there and then changed back again to a market value once we fully went to the net system. But in summary, essentially all of the districts would still be subject to a debt limit, but they would either be subject to the debt limit in Subdivision 4 if Subdivision 5 were repealed.
Representative Greiling, you were first on the list, and then we'll go to Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I do support Representative Qualm's bill because it's going in my philosophical direction. I wish Representative Dabney wouldn't have reminded me that you're compounding this problem, though, with other legislation that you have only for the cities of the first class. And I think, everything that you said, Mr. Chair, and that Representative Dabney said, and the staff squares with why, my understanding too, of why we do nothing with this, because it's hard and everybody wants to have some and not others of each other's statutes. So that's why, you know, I think it's going to take a lot of work to get its uniform. But I think the time has come because Rochester has given us the perfect opportunity. They're going to be looking with fresh eyes at everything that they don't get to do anymore or what they do. And so, Representative Quam, I think you should work on this and come up with all the things that make the most sense for the most districts and get rid of all these artifacts in addition to the one you're getting rid of today. And then along with that, that would include not coming up with any more things that are different.
Mr. Crow wanted to add an additional comment, or Mr. Strom did.
Mr. Chair and members, one other relevant point in regard to the cities of the first class and their debt limit is that the recent practice has been to adopt specific dollar amount debt limits for Minneapolis and St. Paul, and notwithstanding, and we do that usually in session law in bills every 5 to 10 years, and when the legislature adopts those specific debt limits, they notwithstand the provisions that are in subdivision 5. So effectively, for the city, we've been preempting this statute in the recent past in session law in order to set the debt limits for those city or for those school districts.
So Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just have a geography question. We had a presentation from Byron yesterday, and I thought they said they were like 8 or 9 miles west of Rochester, and now part of their district is in the city of Rochester itself. Is that correct?
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, yes. Byron, when my grandparents attended, was extremely rural farm and a small city of Byron component. When I attended, is around the time it shifted from being mostly city residents versus rural residents. So the rural part of the Byron School District has now been, I guess, annexed and is part of the city of Rochester, and that's part of the reason why the population of my district has increased by over 30% because of the growth of Rochester into the surrounding areas. And then Stuartville is in the same situation, where the rural areas of the school district are now part of, or some of them are part of Rochester.
Representative Anderson? Any additional comments or questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Quam renews his motion to have House file. Representative Quam, did you have any closing comments?
Not at this time.
Representative Quam renews his motion to have House File 2917 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much, and thank you for your riveting testimony, sir. Thank you. All right, so Representative Anzels moves approval of the minutes from March 20th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Next on the agenda is we have a special presentation. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jack Alwell, and this is Joe McCarthy. We are both teachers, physical education teachers in the city of Farmington, and we are here on behalf of Minnesota AFERD, which is the state physical education, health, recreation, and dance organization. And we're here to talk to you about the connection between physical activity, physical fitness, and learning. And in this room, there are many, many decisions that really impact the education of our students in the state of Minnesota. And consequently, we hope to inform you about many of the things that are impact the learning of students, some of which have to do with physical education. But mainly, we're here to talk about physical activity and its impact. And we do have a PowerPoint that we would like to show, and I hope that it does not appear that we're trying to have you drink out of a fire hydrant, but we do have a lot of information that that I think is very pertinent to the student learning. And so consequently, I hope this comes up. It was up earlier.
The pages want to help out just to make sure we have this.
Getting close.
Yep.
Thank you. Nothing to it, I hope.
There we go.
Well, first of all, just to get a little background on Joe and myself. I'm a 35-year physical educator. I'm also a high school tennis coach. And one of the things, I guess just anecdotally, that I would like to say is, as a tennis coach, I'm always looking for ways to improve my students' play, my players' play. And sometimes it's quite difficult to get them to become better players in a short period of time. So what we try to do is find skills and techniques that are easily taught to change the outcome of matches. And so I will often say to them, you know, today we're going to be working on something that if you will do this two-thirds of the time, you will win a lot more points and a lot more matches. Are you interested in doing that? And they all have a resounding yes. And then I tell them which shot we're working on, and they all sigh and complain. And I think in a lot of cases, physical education may be the redheaded stepchild of education, but I hope after today you will view it differently. One of the things that Thomas Jefferson, who I think most of us recall, was when President Kennedy was in office, he hosted a dinner for Nobel Prize winners of that particular year, and he said in introduction that this is the most intelligence we've had in this room since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. And if you see on the screen, you'll see that there is a quote from him, and he valued physical exercise greatly, and not so much for what it did for the body, but for what it did for the mind. You're probably aware of Minnesota Promise, and Minnesota Promise is a group of organizations that started in 2005 and includes the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, School Board Association, Elementary Principals Association, and many more, including Education Minnesota. And one of their strategies to produce world-class schools in Minnesota is strategy number 6, which basically boiled down to this. We must base students' education on proven practices and solid evidence. We should expand what works and stop doing what doesn't. And that can be quite difficult, but hopefully after today, you will see that there are certain things that do work and certain things that don't work. Dr. John Medina, who is a developmental molecular biology and professor of bioengineering at the University of Washington School of Medicine, has an excellent book for those of you. It's an easy read. It's called Brain Rules. But basically he says this: if you're in the business of education, you're in the business of brain development. Every bit of learning goes on obviously takes place in the brain. And he famously has said this, that cutting off exercise, which is the very activity most likely to promote cognitive performance, just to do better on a test score is like trying to gain weight by starving yourself. And I think what we'll see, I will try and skip through this very quickly, but the brain is 1% of our body weight, and yet it is takes 25% of our cardiac output. 25% of all blood goes to feed the brain. 20% of all of our total oxygen intake feeds the brain, and 25% of our energy stores goes to feed the brain. There is close to 120 billion neurons and 100 trillion synapses. So there's a lot happening there, and what happens in the brain is extremely important, and that's what educators are trying to do. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about what mice have taught us about the brain. I'll give you a little historical perspective. In the 1940s, a professor named Hebb out of McGill University, apparently they had lax lab rules then. He would take mice home, some mice home, and let them play with his kids. And then at the end of the session, they would do learning tests. And he found out that the mice that he had brought home to play with his children did much better on learning tests than the mice that remained back in the cages. And he came up with a theory, use-dependent plasticity, meaning sort of if you use it, it grows. If you don't, it shrinks. In the 1960s, the University of California at Berkeley professors, researchers, they took two sets of mice, one in cages, barren cages, and one in cages with wheels and toys and things like that. And they found out that the mice in the toys ended up with, they were much better on learning tests, had healthier brains, heavier brains. And as a result of this, the Head Start program, the federal Head Start program, started as a result of that research, showing that when you have environmental enrichment, which is what the toys were, you also have an increase in learning. Back in the 1970s, a professor from the University of Illinois found that running mice in enriched environments also have greater dendrite growth, which is probably unimportant to you right now, but it essentially is creates many more connections in the brain, and consequently there's more communication between the neurons. In the 1990s, Kottman found that a neurotrophin called BDNF was more common in mice that were running. Now, BDNF happens to be associated with neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells. And it's sort of like if you're on the other side of the river and you have an important message to bring to this side of the river, there is a slow way to get across and then there's a fast way. And what BDNF does and other neurotrophins does is they're bridge builders. And they're sort of like the carpenters. They get out there and they build a bridge. They don't have the message themselves, but they enable that message to get there efficiently and more quickly. And that's what BDNF does in the brain. In the 1990s, we found out that running mice have new brain cells in the hippocampus, which is the area of the brain responsible for memory and learning. A little later, we found out that these mice, the new brain cells was in direct proportion to the amount that they ran. So the more you run, the more new brain cells you have, and the greater learning takes place. And finally, we found out that if you force mice to run further than they want to, you not only get growth in the area of memory, but you also get growth in decision-making. Not that mice are great decision-makers, but the fact is that you have a different part of the brain that's being affected. Here is a slide from Dr. John Rady at Harvard that shows in a human brain that there is growth after exercise. This one also shows that there's greater blood flowing to the area that's being serviced. I will skip on to the next one now. So what does that mean for our students? All right, what does activity mean for our students? Well, Dr. Chuck Hillman from the University of Illinois took 20 students, young kids, and he had them sit. And then photo on your left is the 20 students that composite their brain scan. And the blue is the inactive area, and the lighter colors are the more active areas. Then he had the same 20 students go out on a 20-minute brisk walk and did the same brain scan, and you can see that the brain is lit up. Now, as a classroom teacher, which brain do you think would be more effective in terms of learning? And I think the answer to that is fairly clear. We want to have those kids with their brains lit up. So what happens to learners after exercise? One, the memory is sharper. We have research that shows that vocabulary, which is probably the basic of memory and learning, exercises learn 20% faster and have 20% better memory. Here's an important thing. There was a study in North Carolina that shows that after exercise, there is up to a 20% increase in on-task behavior in the classroom. I don't know how many of you have remember your long classroom sessions, and I hope this doesn't turn into one, but the mind wanders quite often. And the kids that are most affected are the ones who are least on task. We found out that after exercise, reading comprehension goes up by one full grade level. They haven't learned it, but they're dialed in at much better. Response and accuracy time has improved. You get better answers, you get them more quickly. Higher order thinking is enhanced. Now, I don't know if many of you know this, but Google, that corporation out in the West Coast that we're all attached to, their boardroom does not have chairs and desks like yours. They have walking desks or treadmills. So their meetings are all done on a treadmill at 1 mile an hour, and the purpose of which is to create more cognitive flexibility. In other words, they think better. They make connections a lot better. Finally, self-control improves greatly. There's a school in South Carolina, Charleston Progressive School, that used to have the kids that get dropped off like 40 minutes before school began. 40 minutes. What are we going to do with these kids? Well, they knew what to do. They were going to be fighting. Right? They had conflicts throughout the day. So finally they decided, well, we've got to do something with these kids. They set up stations in the gym, and they allowed the kids to pick whatever stations they want, but each one involved activity. And what happened was within 1 year, referrals went from 661 to 71, to 353, and suspensions dropped from 71 to 24. So the behavior changed a great deal. Those are all important things that when it comes to getting students ready to learn. Now, these charts here are from Naperville Central in Illinois, and what they did a number of years ago is they took some students that were below grade level in reading, and they had a voluntary class at 7 in the morning. Kids would come in on their own, and they would participate in a physical education class that was vigorous, and then they would head off to their reading class. And they found out that the kids that did this, they improved three times the speed of the average kids. This is something that's been happening in Farmington. Over the last 6 years, we have conducted these tests with everyone from second grade through sixth grade. And we've, as you can see, received the same exact results. The national average is between 2 and 3 RIT, and the kids that take place, that participate in this class, they improve at roughly 5 times the national average. And it's been replicated many times. Now, physically active kids also, and we just spoke about exercise, but physically active kids that have an active lifestyle, they also achieve better. In 2003, Sibley took a look at 44 different studies and found out that there was a positive correlation between activity alone and 7 categories of cognitive performance, including IQ, academic achievement, readiness, and et cetera. Kottman found out that the rate of learning increases, and Davis found out that the amount of improvement is related directly to the amount of exercise. She did a study with overweight kids in Augusta, Georgia, and they found out that kids that did 20 minutes of activity a day improved to a certain level. Kids that did 40 improved twice that. So do physically active kids actually achieve better? The answer to that is yes, and there is a movement underfoot in the United States, I'm sure you're well aware of it, to reduce physical activity and physical education time and replace that with classroom time, but there has yet to be a study that shows that that is an effective means of increasing academic performance. In fact, it's been shown actually to hurt it in many situations. And there is a landmark study in Titusville, Pennsylvania. Some of you may know that as the very first city in America that had an oil well. Well, now it is part of the Rust Belt, and they have a high level of free and reduced lunch. Well, what they did, they were in serious trouble academically. They were behind state standards or averages in reading and math. And so they tried something daring. They lengthened the school day, and they shortened each of the classes so that every student could have everyday physical education. And in a single year, they ended up at 17% above the state average in reading and 18% above the state average in math as a result of that added activity. We've also found that active kids had significantly higher academic grades in elementary school as well. That last study was at middle school. And we have found also that those students that are active in self-report activity end up with much higher scores on their tests. The only problem, of course, is that physical activity is declining all across America. In fact, it's as I mentioned, I've been teaching 35 years. The amount of activity and the size of our kids has been, they've been passing in the night. One is going one way and the other is going the other way. But here's some data that shows how little the students are participating in any sort of physical activity whatsoever. In fact, I just returned from Boston, where I was had the privilege of listening to Jared, the subway pitch man. Now, I never took him seriously until I actually heard him speak. But he had a very compelling story. When he was in fourth and fifth grade, and his dad is a physician, by the way, and so he was raised in a family that understood health. But by the time he was in fourth grade, he began to spend a lot of time in front of Xboxes and various other self-entertaining forms. And by the time he was in a senior in high school, he weighed 425 pounds. And you can well imagine his state of mind. He enrolled in the University of Indiana, and after his freshman year, where he continued to gain weight, he moved off campus and happened to move into an apartment right next door to Subway. And he went in one day and saw the signs that showed the fat grams, and he thought, you know, I need to make a change. And literally within a year, he had, on nutrition alone, he dropped 100 and some odd pounds. He began exercising. And within a year and a half, he'd lost over 200 pounds. And so what you see on TV is not a gimmick, which I kind of thought perhaps it was, that he had a series of other things that were going on. But he literally changed his life that way and now has a foundation. But I want you to think about this, and Joe will talk about this in a few minutes, but scientists and researchers say that by the age of 11, obesity is persistent, meaning people like Jared are extremely rare, and I'm sure you'll understand that. But obesity has a devastating effect on learning, which we'll talk about in a minute. And I think
Are you up here?
I'm up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you're going to see next is how fitness is the key to academic achievement and success. This is the California Department of Study back in 2001, in which they studied over 1 million kids in grades 5, 7, and 9. So we're taking a look at a large, vast group of elementary, middle school, and high school students. And as you can see on the slide, it talks about higher academic achievement and how it's related to academic success and fitness success. As the students become more fit, so does their academic achievement goes up as it relates to math and reading. This is 2001 California study. Next is the Massachusetts study. A little bit more recent, same thing. 2,000 students in grades 4, 6, 7, and 8. And they found the same thing. There is a significant relationship between academic achievement and fitness. And as you can see on the bottom, it talks about as fitness increases one level, so does their math score goes up by 38%, and their reading score goes up by 24%. Next, Texas Youth Fitness Study, 2009, 2.4 million kids. Large study. They found the same thing in grades 3 through 12 with the associated with the Cooper Institute. Higher levels of fitness are associated with academic achievement. Students are in school because they're healthier. They're there more often. And finally, they feel better about themselves. As the body moves, there's a brain chemical in the brain, called endorphins. Endorphins are released every time you're moved. It makes you feel better about yourself. This is huge when it comes down to behavior. Personal story of mine, I was speaking to my principal last week and I asked him about our behavior problems at our school. 3 years ago, we started three programs, a running club at recess, a gym and minute during the classroom day, and a century club, in which kids are active at school. He said before these programs started, there were behavior problems. But now he sees none. It's rare if he sees one a month because the kids are active. They feel better about themselves. They want to be in school and they're healthy. This is the Mecca study that we want to spend a few minutes on. This is Anthony Elementary in Kansas, where it's a school district of 10 elementary schools. They were 10th in reading, 9th in math. Okay, they had to do something. So what did they do? They went from one day of FIAD and movement to 5 days of FIAD and movement. They changed their nutritional standards, and they gave them some vitamins with their parents' permission, of course. What happened was they went from 10th in reading to 2nd in reading, 9th in math to 1st in math after 1 year. 10th to 2nd, 9th to 1st after 1 year by adding movement and directed instruction. If you look at the behavior incidences, 438 to 18. A huge change of culture. 1 year of adding activity and movement throughout the day. Conrad out of Illinois. There was 5 sessions of 3rd grade students. The teacher said, "Hey, principal, can we try a study?" He said, "Sure." So here's what they did. The control group went 3 sections of 2 days of FIAD. The other group went everyday FIAD. And as you can see, the results were the same. Fitness scores went up, math went up, reading doubled after 1 year. Denmark. They went from PE, 1 day a week, to 5 days a week. Same thing. If we look at the bottom, look at their grades. Their grades went up by an average of 1.5 letter grades. Look what the teacher's remarks were. The increase has greatly affected their classroom behavior. Kids are energized, they're ready, and they're engaged to learn, which is what we all want. Swedish military study. They studied the military men who enlisted between 1950 and 1976, and they followed them for a while. And here's what they found out. Cardiovascular fitness possibly associated with intelligence. Now, here's the key is, part of this group was identical twins. So whatever happened inside of them was the same. It had to be external factors that changed or caused something that was different. Number 2, it predicted cognitive performance at age 18. Started at age 15 to 18. And then finally, number 3, it predicted higher socioeconomic economic status and educational attainment later in life. So they got the better jobs. They were able to go to better schools later in life. This is out of Sweden. Next one. Cardiovascular fitness is decreasing. So are our test scores. So is the mood. So is behavior. What we need to change is we need more opportunities. As you can see, later in life, the cardiovascular fitness is decreasing. As they get to middle school and high school, and so are the opportunities to move. So our goal is to increase those, to provide more opportunities, to increase their test scores, and to also to increase their positive behavior. Next, overweight and obesity, which is the enemy of learning. Here are some of the problems it causes. Overweight students are not there as often. They're 25% more absent. They're almost 40% tardy. And they're focused on the wrong thing. They're not focused on learning. They're thinking about how am I going to get to the next classroom without being picked on, which is sad. Academic achievement, higher BMI associated with lower test scores. We want that to be the opposite. And finally, the behavior. Okay, obese kids are being picked on. They're being targeted 3 times as more likely than normal weight students. And as you can see right now, here's what's happening to our society back in 1985. Okay, with every year passes, so does obesity increases. Would anybody like to share a word on what they just saw? Anything that came to mind? It's scary. And it's going to keep getting worse unless we make dramatic changes in our educational system. And what you see here is overweight with our youth, ages 6 to 19. And what you see is the same thing. Jack talked about this before. 86% of 10-year-olds, which is what we see, we are K-5 teachers. Those are our fourth and fifth graders. 86% of them, if they are overweight, they are going to remain overweight and obese adults. And by age 11, it becomes persistent. So our goal is to create habits of movement because we know the importance of why it's important to be active, but also we teach them how to be active as well for a lifetime. We want lifetime learners. We want lifetime active learners. And this shows even down to 4 years old. If they have early onset obesity, it affects their IQ. Okay, I'm going to finish up. I appreciate your patience. I just want to talk a little bit about one of the more effective things. A lot of times sports is substituted for physical education, but it's found out that in sports groups that you do not increase your test scores and you do not reduce your body fat. That was a study out of Australia this year, just came out. The Robert Wood Foundation found out that for each day that a student is in physical education, their likelihood of being obese is reduced by 5% up to nearly 30% if they have 5 days a week, which is quite rare. Incidentally, in the school that I teach in, our district has 2 days, or I should say every other day, physical education in the elementary schools. But for the last 15 years, we've had it every single day. However, it's necessitated larger groups of kids that come into the gym. But for those of you that understand elementary schedules, prime time in an elementary school is the first session in the morning. So that's usually reserved for reading. And in the 35 years that I've taught, reading has been every grade level immediately as the school day began. But 2 or 3 years ago, we instituted a policy called balanced literacy, which mandated an uninterrupted 90 minutes of literacy each day. You could do it anytime you wanted, but everybody wants to do it in the morning. And what that meant was that our classes or students would not be getting everyday physical education. That was the consequence or the fallout. And so, surprising to me, and I think to everybody else, our teachers voted unanimously, we'd rather have everyday physical education and move literacy to the afternoon because we've seen the effects that it has behaviorally and academically on all of our kids. So, I found that to be probably the highest compliment that a teacher could give, is that they valued that. The school, by the way, that we talked about, Naperville, Illinois, they have finished number one in the world in the TIMSS test, which is a science and math test. And their parents rate physical education as the number one curricular subject in the school. And that is a terrific compliment. I guess I just want to finish by talking a little bit about recess. Now, recess gets kicked around a lot. There's a school district in Florida in which it's against the rules to run at recess. I'm not sure who's driving that, but you can't run at recess. But one of the things that researchers have found is that all species play and need to play. And if you deny them the ability to play, you have problems. You have social problems and developmental problems. Well, this slide, you're going to see four slides. This was presented by Dr. John Rady at a recent workshop. But this was these pictures were taken by a photographer for National Geographic. And he was following a dog sled team across the Arctic. And the team was just getting ready to settle down for the night. And into camp comes a polar bear. Polar bears, as you know, are not being fed as well as they once were. And he was looking for a meal. And you can see that this dog in particular recognizes that. But as the dog sled leader said, we have one dog that is not as bright as the others. And that dog misinterpreted the bear's advance as wanting to play. And so this is the bear, the hungry bear, and the dog, followed by this. He's not eating the dog. He's embracing the dog. And this. Now, the interesting thing is that they were in that area for 6 days, and the bear came back every night to play. Every night to play. Now, the reason I say that is because in a lot of cases, we forget how important play is and how important independent play is. Now, there's research out there that says that at recess, kids will not develop cardiovascularly. They will not. They will do other things. And as a result, sometimes recess is not treated with any sort of respect because there's no organization to it. But I will say this, is that when they have stopped animals from playing, they have found that there's smaller brain growth in those animals, fewer social skills, they become more aggressive, and they're less intelligent. So something we don't want to let happen to our kids. One of the things that Finland does, and I just found this out, that all Finnish schools do this apparently, is they have hour-long blocks, educational blocks. And 15 minutes of every educational block is devoted to recess. And they have the highest scores in the European Union. So something that's not unusual. The further you go north in the United States, the higher the test scores are. The further north you go in Europe, the same thing occurs. But they've been doing this for a long, long time, and their test scores show it. So I guess I just want to thank you all. I know that you're probably wondering why are you doing this. We're not here really to ask for anything, but we do really want for you to consider what an important tool physical education is in the learner's mind, in the learner's development. Paul Zentarski from Naperville Central says this about physical education. He says, as physical educators, we just create brain cells. The teachers need to fill them. And that's essentially what we're here to say, is that we believe that physical education should be one of the core subjects. We feel that if it is part of the core subjects in the state of Minnesota, you will see a change in the academic outcomes of the learners in this state. And you know that a number of years ago, we both lost our voice at the State Department. We no longer have a liaison in physical education. And as a result, the standards were dropped. They've been reinstated. And yet we've lost ground. And I feel as though we've lost ground not just in the physical sense. Obviously, Joe and I are here concerned about the physical health of our kids. We're concerned, like I tell my tennis players, I'm more concerned about your tennis when you're 35 than I am when you're 17. I want this to be something that goes through your life. And the same thing is true with us, with our kids. We want our kids to be healthy adults with an active lifestyle. And as a result, we feel that it's how you finish the race rather than how you start the race. But how you start the race oftentimes determines how you finish. And I feel as though we would be wise if we were to begin rebuilding our physical education curriculum in the state of Minnesota and its place amongst the academic core. And so I guess we've spoken our piece. And if there are any questions, Mr. Chair, or
thank you.
Members?
Thank you for your presentation. We do have a couple questions from members. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, comments to start. We've been, first of all, thank you, because this is a really excellent compilation of research and detail. But we've had this discussion here before. You may or may not be aware, but this is my sixth year here, and we've had it the whole time. We had it around the physical education standards, and how we bring them back into the schools. And then the fight was mandate versus no mandate, because schools are feeling a lot of pressure from a lot of directions. And so as I've observed this discussion, one of the things that it seems to me has to happen is conversation among educators across disciplines, because we're siloed, segregated, however you want to think of it. You know, you teach PE at a certain time and we teach reading at a certain time. That model that you spoke about from Finland, I think, is really key. And if we could figure out, as a parent, I thought this when my kids were in elementary school, I talked to the teachers, 5 minutes, let them get up and move around, stand up, stretch, do something, because they're restless, So how do we get that conversation across disciplines in a way that integrates physical education into the daily life?
Mr. Ola?
Mr. Chair and Representative, one of the things that's starting to happen across the country is there's starting to become an integration of physical education and academics. One of the things that's been shown in research is that you can't learn difficult material during vigorous activity. You cannot do that. However, any material that's difficult that's learned after vigorous physical activity is remembered much better and learned better. I will say that those graphs that you saw from both Farmington schools and Naperville schools are an indication that the two can coexist. In fact, the class that we run is 15 minutes long at the start of the school day. And I've told that other school districts, they encourage their kids to take physical education immediately before the most difficult subject that they've got. So I think the number one thing that has to happen is that I think knowledge creates responsibility. Once we know something is true, then we have a responsibility to react to that in some way. And I realize there's lots of things that also mitigate our ability to make that decision. But the fact is that if activity does create better learners, then how do we get more activity to our learners? And the beauty of physical activity is that people enjoy it. I mean, people love it. In fact, one of the things that we like to say is that as a physical education teacher, if you're not a rock star, it's your own fault in an elementary school. That's not necessarily true at the secondary, but we certainly believe that kids are eager to do the things that we want to present to them.
All right. One more follow-up. When you go from the sitting to the standing, you activate 8% more of your brain activity. So anytime you feel sluggish, just stand up. You activate 8% more of your brain ready to learn, which is what you're talking about. We want kids to move.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Jack, you have me beat by a year. I spent 34 years in teaching physical education. So, and Joe, I think I've got quite a few years on you. But thanks for your presentation today. It's exciting to know that there's other people out there who think along the same lines. In the district that I taught in rural Minnesota, I spent the last 10 or 12 years teaching a zero-hour class. It started at 7:15, 7:20 in the morning, and it was one of the largest classes in the school. I didn't find out until after I left how much students actually appreciated me being there, but that's a whole other story. The other thing that we do in where I live is a lot of teams practice in the morning before school. It kind of gets their motors running, and those are good. In our elementary school, they have open gym in the morning. Kids can come in for a half an hour before school and shoot baskets or, do whatever they want, you might say. So I understand the value of that. The other thing I was going to suggest, too, is after our presentations that we've had here with regards to a digital learning, if we had physical education class and then went into digital learning right after that, we'd be in the 22nd century. So keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I too enjoyed the presentation. Your passion is evident, and keep up the good work. I was talking to a school nurse a while back, and the discussion was on, it seemed like there were more kids being diagnosed as ADH recently, and it was her opinion that possibly it could be part of it due to the lack of activity that kids have, too much sitting in front of the TV or the video games and such. Do you have any statistics on physical education activity helping in that area as well?
Mr. Orwell.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have plenty of that. In fact, in your handouts, on the very last page, there is a letter from a high school principal in Wyoming to Dr. John Rady, who is, you probably know, is in the medical school at Harvard. And basically what he's saying is that I don't have any research to tell us how many we have in terms of, but it seems like the number is growing, as you were mentioning. And I do think there's contributing factors, both inactivity and poor nutrition, I think, are playing an important role. But Dr. Ken Cooper, who is the father of aerobics in the United States, maybe some of you know, he's a doctor in the Air Force. I heard him speak last week, and he said this. He said that he went to the school board in Dallas, and he said, would you give me your 10 worst students, males and females, your gangbangers and the people that don't care, would you just give them to me? They have to want to come to me, but would you give them to me? Because I'd like to put them in a 10-week program where two times a week we have 75 minutes of, not boot camp, but pretty serious exercise. And he said, after the 10 weeks, several things happened. First of all, their attendance was very good. Second of all, their weight began to improve, their academics and their interests began to improve. But they begged Dr. Cooper to please continue this program. It's saving my life. And he said, well, unfortunately, we're only going to go for the 10 weeks. And they said, well, if you're only going to go for 10 weeks, would you reinstate it next year? Because I'd love to see my friends and my neighbors go through this. And so I guess what I'm saying is that we don't have a lot of statistics at the current time that deal with that, but I think the targeted area where this is the most effective is in underprivileged and underserved groups, where it has the greatest impact. One of the things that I think you saw from the Naperville and from the Farmington charts was that the kids who are low achievers, in essence, they are given a greater boost by this activity. The kids who have lower self-esteem are given a greater boost by this. The kids that are least on task are given the greatest boost. And the kids that are least likely to attend school are the ones that turn their attention around. So we do have stats, and I can certainly forward them to you. I didn't include all of them in here. I just tried to give you some flavor of what's going on out there. But it does take a long time to change the educational landscape. And it starts by making believers out of, people like yourselves that make decisions that affect the kids that we have. In fact, you've probably heard this. This generation of children now is the first one that is likely to live a shorter lifespan than the generation before it. First one in history. So we have to be very careful about what we do.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for this presentation. I think I have a couple of questions and comments. So have you been here before?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so this is the same group, the one. Okay, I didn't know if your model had expanded and now we had new disciples. So I would like to just say a couple of things and ask a question. First of all, is you have commented that we need to rebuild what we have, and I would say for this environment, I would stop using that as your goal, rebuilding, because, and I know there are probably people disagreeing with me, that's okay, that's all right. I think you just need to start from scratch again, because I think we are in such a different generation and such a different frame of what people think about physical activity and their thinking and the way that they spend their time. And I'm saying that in context of you're talking to a lot of people who still have very... they think of physical education. When you use the word physical education, I don't know if you know it, but for many people, that just immediately pops into into your mind some memories. And they haven't all been good. And they are some of the most painful memories for a lot of people in society. And so I would start reframing how I do this. And I think what we also need to do is we need to teach people about the way physical education is currently being taught, because from the conversations that I have had with the physical educators in my district, and I'm just more familiar with it because that's my kid's favorite class. I think physical education has changed dramatically, and I think you need to start, instead of rebuild the old, I think you need to start talking about the new and what is the new, and I think, so anyhow, The other thing that I wanted to know then is you say that you don't have any suggestions, and I would strongly urge you to start coming with suggestions. I think information is good. We get so much information. But I think, as Representative Reinhart said, within your community, you need to come with some cost-effective, efficient solutions. And the first time I heard you, I thought, this is remarkable, taking 15 minutes a day and achieving a goal that has that reaps such benefits that nobody can disagree with. You've got plenty of research to demonstrate that. And if you just ask people, everybody even sitting at this table would agree, physical activity makes you feel better. You know that. It's just, it's a law of nature. Nobody can disagree with it. So I would strongly encourage you to develop something that can be implemented statewide that doesn't get all messed up with, you know, 30 different standards that now needs to be integrated into the day, and how do we extend the day or pay teachers or what do we eliminate, and something that does not get mixed up in all of that, and also takes into account that a lot of kids right now are very active, and I think we've got a pretty big gap. The active are getting more active and highly competitive, and then the sedimentary are getting more sedimentary, and so how do you reach both those audiences? Because like I said, the word physical education conjures up memories for all of us. The other thing is, have you ever done a cost analysis of what your program took to implement?
Mr. Olwell.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it cost $84 to do the program that we did, and most of that $84 was wasted on things that we didn't eventually use. I donated my time, and the materials were minimal, and consequently, in fact, the same thing is true for everyday physical education. It hasn't cost anything, but part of the reason is we have larger groups just because it's such an effective tool. So the cost analysis basically, I know one of the slides that Joe showed of Conrad Elementary where they had some funding and they took everyday physical education for two sections and the cardiovascular fitness went up and so the other, and then when the funding ran out, they shut down the program. And so it's I understand that, in fact, I compare education to my wife's closet, and that is there's a lot of really cool stuff in there already. But if I want to put something new in there, I got to take something out. And consequently, what happens is there's a lot of things that aren't going to come out of that closet. And I'm not sure I want certain things to come out of that closet. But getting back to your earlier point, the research shows that poor physical education has no effect whatsoever. The only physical education that makes a difference is a new physical education that concentrates on the individual, that is not the humiliation that so many of us remember. I mean, I remember it from the 60s doing push-ups in the mud and wrestling in front of the entire class with some 250-pound guy showing me the sun. And it was a humiliating experience. But physical education is not that anymore. And we're not advocating, as you mentioned, I appreciate your comments about rebuilding. I don't want to rebuild the old.
Right.
I want to replace the old with the new. And so forgive me for that phrase. But actually, if you really want to, I mean, if you look at the research, physical education itself is the number one thing that changes both health and test scores. It's the number one thing that leads to it. Being on your seat does not help. Research has shown that. Being on your feet does help. And the last time we came asking for standards, and it was passed. So that was awesome. What we really want, our dream, is mandates, which we are told by everyone has no hope. All right, and consequently, we don't ask for that which we cannot have. But we are interested in both having representation at the State Department of Education, and we're very interested in having physical education as part of the core for Minnesota. And those things, I don't think either one of them would cost very much. We haven't done a cost analysis. But the state of Iowa is doing that precise thing right now. They have legislation asking, and from the governor himself, asking that PE be part of the core. And so that's the next thing on our agenda. this was, I hope, just to inform and get you ready for that next step.
Representative Bynum?
May I just have one follow-up?
Absolutely.
Also like to suggest it on your different pathways of trying to accomplish your goals, which I think are just fabulous. It's just a great message with great results, is to think about trying to replicate your program. And I wouldn't expect, you know, across the state that everybody would donate their time, because that's going to, the first thing to do to destroy a program. But, you know, looking at what would be the cost to add, like, an added hour, added optional hour for students, or, you know, just as an option. And, you know, if you wanted to start it as, you know, a opt-in program, and what would be the cost, and we could, you know, look at it more of a providing funding to keep it, to get it started and keep it going that way. For, and if the results are as you have demonstrated, I think that it would naturally dovetail with the other side of somebody at the department, the standards, and, you know, all that type of stuff. So I just, it's just very invigorating as we all sit here.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Dietrich, Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, I have an exercise ball in my office, and maybe we should have exercise balls at these desks instead of these chairs, but that's a secondary issue. But the other side of what Representative Dietrich is saying is, I mean, I realize you're here speaking to us as legislators, and that's the state perspective, and you probably already do this, but I want to really encourage you to be out there at the School Board Association and your and whatever, wherever you can speak to educators and people who are at the grassroots, because if you bring this experience and opportunity to more individual schools, you're going to build a base of ownership of a movement around this that can lead to the change. And I think it's always better if you can combine grassroots ownership with some broader initiative from the top. But I'm not, even though I'm sitting in this seat, I'm not a big believer in top-down solutions. I think we do better if we can partner with the grassroots. So I'm sure you're doing some of that already, but I just encourage broaden the ownership of your experience and message.
Thank you. I'm sure you're starting to see the your audience here. You have a number of supporters, so this is a very positive. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks so much for your testimony. It really was fascinating, and so I learned so much, so thank you for that. One quick question, because I think some of the comments I'm going to make have already been covered and that, but on all of that data and research that you presented on schools and measuring how reading and mathematics and that performance increased with more physical education for students, was that the only change, or were there curricular things in those reading and math programs going on at the same time? So were they able to isolate that it was just the physical education that was really making those strides and gains with students?
Mr. Owell.
Mr. Chair, Representative. In the specific ones we're showing you, those were isolated, and the only change that happened with those kids is that they came early and had that particular class. And by the way, that class wasn't just physical education. It was physical education with embedded literacy challenges. So to succeed at the game, you also had to solve certain cognitive challenges. And we found that one of the things that Dr. Paul Nussbaum says is that in order for learning to occur, it has to be relevant. And for a lot of kids, school is not relevant. I mean, I hate to say that, but it's true. And once you get students into the gym, you have relevance in their lives. And so consequently, that was the combination that took place there. It's also the combination that took place in Naperville, although they were just physical education.
Senator Wu?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you. Thanks for clarifying that for me. And I've gone back and forth on this just a little bit with the whole effort on mandated physical education, but I think I'm swinging very, very much in that direction from the information you've presented, and I think the suggestions from Representative Dietrich and Briner are very good ones. I think this is would be an excellent grassroots movement. I hope you do, and I'm wondering about the information outflow to schools and that broadly with this information, and I don't know if there's a mechanism set up to do that. Obviously, there's a lot of associations and that exists for our districts. But I hope this is getting out there in a way. I would hope that you'd also expand it out to parent groups too. You know, as a former PTO chair at one of my or of my kids' elementary schools, and I remember the first 2 weeks of school, we'd get we'd have a little parent coffee, and we'd get a lot of kindergarten and first grader parents that would come in, and you know, their first questions were, "Why isn't there more recess? My kid cannot sit still during this long day." And especially as our schools try to go to that, and they have gone to that concentrated reading block, and I hear it so much, especially parents of little boys. I have girls, so I haven't experienced it as much with my own kids, but just, you know, my son likes to read, but he cannot sit still for 90 minutes and read. He needs to get up and move around, and I think that's true for a lot of kids, I will say. I think my younger daughter, that's specifically the case. She's physical education is her favorite class. She's a freshman in high school, and she has always been a kid that just needs to move a little more. And so, I think you'd get a lot of support from parents providing them this information and disseminating it, and you will see more of an effort on the part of the schools to move. I would also encourage you, again, in that creative process of how we can implement some of these things cost effectively, to look at whether or not there could be a component where it's possible in schools for parent volunteers to help with some of this. We tried to do it at school just with more recess, and there was concern, well, we don't have enough to pay the recess monitors. And I'm like, I can get 10 moms or dads here every day for recess if you'll let us do it. And so I hope you will also press schools to utilize the free help and support that parents would be willing to give to make these efforts successful, because I think it's out there.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Can I get feedback on that?
Absolutely.
Representative, Jack and I both have spoke at both of our parent groups. We spoke at both of our schools. Jack and I both spoke at the Minnesota School Board Leadership Conference in January. And then also next week I'm flying out to D.C., to speak with senators and representatives at a national speak out day as well for 3 days next week. So the word is getting out. We are doing our best to advocate and to network with as many connections as we can to spread the good word. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation today. It was is well done and well received, as you can tell. Committee members. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just could we ask that you would send us this presentation electronically? Because I could put it in a file.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee members, thank you for your time. We will meet tomorrow, March 22nd, at 12:30 here, and this meeting is adjourned.